Hello and welcome to episode 3 of 251, two pianists, five podcasts, one subject. I'm Simon Whiteside.
And my name's Nick Tomlin. And in the last episode, we looked at Sonny Clark's work as a sideman, particularly his playing with Buddy DeFranco, Grant Green and Dexter Gordon. And we actually recorded a slightly longer version of that podcast, where we also talked about his work with Sonny Chris and Hank Mobley. And that's actually available on our Patreon page as well.
Yes, and it's worth saying that you can follow the podcast in various ways. You can subscribe on Apple. You can follow on Google and on Spotify. There are various other platforms that if you have a favourite podcast app that you use, we may well be on there as well. It's really helpful to us if you can like, give us some stars and write a comment or two. That would be really fantastic. And if you really want to help, our main way of getting extra resources to help produce the podcast and the book that's coming from it is going to our Patreon page, and that's 251 on the Patreon website. That way, you don't have to give every month. You can, if you want, just give once and then cancel that. It's a very simple thing to do, a one-off payment, as well as a monthly, say, £3 or something. Anyway, we're going to carry on with the podcast today and thank all of our listeners so far who have been downloading and listening to our podcast.
So Sonny Clark moved to New York in 1957. He'd been touring a little bit with Dinah Washington and moved there from the West Coast, where he spent most of his early life. And in June of 1957, he did a session with Hank Mobley, which was later released as a Hank Mobley album. And that's really where Alfred Lion first heard Sonny Clark, and on the strength of that, he was very impressed with Sonny Clark, and he offered him his own date for Blue Note. They went back into the studio. It was about a month later, so the Hank Mobley recording was in June of 1957, and in July 1957, July the 21st, they went back in, and they recorded the session that became known as Dial S for Sonny, which was Sonny Clark's first recording under his own name for the Blue Note label. And the personnel on that record were, he used Art Farmer, who I think he'd known from the West Coast. Art Farmer was on trumpet, Curtis Fuller trombone. I think he'd heard him in Dizzy Gillespie's band. Hank Mobley, obviously, who he'd already recorded with. Wilbur Ware, who I think he'd played with in Chicago when he was touring with Buddy DeFranco's band, and Lewis Hayes on drums. So that was the personnel who went into the studio on July the 21st, 1957.
Yes, and it's obviously Dial S for Sonny is a reference to the Hitchcock film Dial M for Murder, which came out in 1954 and was very successful. So a little bit of a sort of joke there. Remembering that in that time, you would dial the area code in letters on your phone and then the number afterwards. So for example, Soho 1362 or whatever. Now, that album and all of the albums up until his last solo album were recorded at Hackensack Studios by Rudy Van Gelder. And he was experimenting at this time with what he called his 50-50 method. So he was using a stereo tape machine, but he was monitoring through one speaker. Generally speaking, for the early albums, and this goes for everything up until Leaping and Loping, he would have the horns, any horns, on the left, piano centre, bass and drums on the right. It was all about the mono mix, and he was listening to how those things combined through the single speaker. So, as Nick said, Dial S for Sonny was recorded in July 1957, and we're going to talk about a few of the... We're going to go over the tunes as a brief précis, and then we're going to talk about Sonny's mood in detail, aren't we, Nick?
Yes, that's right, yeah. And I think what's interesting about this album, there are three originals on this album. Sorry, four originals. Four originals on this album and two standards. They do two standards as well. So there's a real focus here on Sonny's compositions. And he'd recorded a couple of compositions before for when he was with Buddy DeFranco, But it's clear here that he's really sort of stepping into the limelight as a composer. And it really strikes me how competent he is as a composer, and also how interesting these compositions are. And I think at this time, majority of jazz compositions still tended to be either blues, either minor or major blues, and rhythm changes with some variations. I mean, sometimes the blues would have a bridge. Sometimes the rhythm changes, the middle section would be slightly different. But I feel that Sonny Clark here is really, he's sort of really trying to step away from these models, really. And although, you know, he does use the blues and he does use rhythm changes, in fact, both of those on this album, it's a long way from just cobbling together a blues and blowing through the changes. It's, you know, he's really thinking about the compositions in the arrangements. I don't know how you feel about that, Simon.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think we should let everyone know what is on those albums. Obviously, they can listen to the playlists that we've put up on Spotify and Apple Music. So the first tune is Dial S for Sonny, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, well, it's sort of a blues, isn't it? But it isn't a blues. And this is what you've just really said. It's sort of a blues. It's a 12-bar structure, but doesn't go to the four, for example. So I've got eight bars, four bars repeated, sort of F minor going to A flat, and then
yeah,
a 2-5-1 minor, 2-5-1 into F minor for the last of the 12 bars. And it's a bit of a weird one because it ends in a very odd fashion, doesn't it, with the bass
yeah.
sort of...
Yes, it is. It is. It's quite a strange ending. I think also what's interesting, the soloing sequence is different from the head sequence, or it's a kind of expanded version. So again, he's not just thinking of just blowing on the changes of the head. He's actually constructed a kind of solo section, which really, you know, to me shows that he's thinking compositionally, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is something that came. I mean, in the track Sonny's Idea, it was again, it was a rhythm changes, but I don't think you would necessarily identify it as a rhythm changes from his head. I mean, what do you think in comparison with Booting It, which is next, isn't it?
That's a much more straightforward bebop tune, really, isn't it? It's a blues, although. With altered changes, it's not a straightforward blues, but the head is very bebop influenced, you know, very almost Charlie Parker like.
Yeah. That's definitely. I would agree with that. And then they move on to quite a slow version, which I think catches Wilbur Ware out a bit.
Yeah, I don't think it's Wilbur Ware's best day in the studio. I think we could maybe say that on this album.
So they do It Could Happen to You. I mean, so notably for me, there was that sort of almost Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square type introduction, which Sonny Clark seems to favour. And I found his solo very fluid on that. That leads us to Sonny's Mood, which we won't talk about now because we're going to talk about that in detail. The next tune after that is Shouting on a Riff. And that is a rhythm changes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically a rhythm changes in F, but with an altered bridge. So the it doesn't use a traditional I Got Rhythm bridge. It's sort of re-harmonized, really.
Yeah. And interestingly, Love Walked In at the end, it's almost a trio number, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Perhaps that's something we could refer back to. Because there seem to be quite a few albums where he did that. You know, there's a little trio number fitted in. You had that.
It was.
What was the tune on the Jimmy Rainey?
Once in a While, yes, yeah.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes now to talk about Sonny's Mood in a bit of detail. So, he seems to like F, doesn't he, as a key centre?
There are a lot of tunes in F, yeah, for sure.
This one being in F major, it's a sort of AABA structure.
Yeah.
I mean, he seems to be one of those players who likes to pick up after the bar starts as opposed to go into the bar, if that makes sense.
Mm.
So there are a lot of his phrases in soloing and in tune writing that start on the and of two. In this one, He really likes that sort of triplet on the second beat as well, doesn't he? It seems to be quite a feature of his playing. I suppose he likes to quite often go into Latin for the second section, or start in Latin and go into swing,
yeah,
which was quite popular around that time.
Yeah, I mean, this one sort of has a Latin bridge, doesn't it? It sort of starts off swing and then goes to Latin. I suppose it's more usual to do it the other way around, although, I mean, there are quite a lot of tunes that do that, don't they? They have a kind of Latin middle section.
Yeah. He does seem to be very aware of contrast. So his bridges are often... I mean, bridges nearly are always different, and that's the point of them being there. But his ones are really different. He puts in a new idea, and then he doesn't put in several new ideas over eight bars. He kind of uses one idea, doesn't he?
Mm.
So in this case, that sort of do-dee-da, 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 and he just keeps on with that simple but effective rhythmic and thematic idea.
Mm.
I did like the way in which he,
yeah,
he does sort of also break up his comping from sort of staccato and legato-ish, if that is possible on a piano. Quasi-legato, perhaps, is a better way of putting it. In the comping behind people, he's quite sensitive, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really comes through on all of his albums for Blue Note, really. His comping is really... It's varied and he never get the sense with him like the best piano players that he's just sitting there kind of waiting for his solo, that he's really trying to add to the texture and he's always thinking and always changing. I mean, particularly for me on Cool Strutting, but on all of these albums, I mean, his comping is just remarkable, I think.
Yeah, I think it is a very strong element to his success as a pianist. Well, we've made a solemn pledge to keep this podcast shorter. So we're going to wrap up on the first album there and move on to his second album in a moment. So the second album that Sonny Clarke recorded for Blue Note was called Sonny's Crib. It had Donald Byrd on trumpet, Curtis Fuller again on trombone, but... this time on tenor saxophone, John Coltrane. Obviously, Sonny Clarke on piano. And we had a combination of Paul Chambers on bass and Art Taylor on drums. And for the album release, which was one of the 1500 series for Blue Note, they released five songs, with A Song in My Heart, Speak Low, Come Rain or Come Shine, and two originals, Sonny's Crib and News for Lulu.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, just briefly looking at where John Coltrane was, really, when he recorded this album. So in April of 1957, it was kind of a bit of a low point for him, really. I mean, he'd been sacked from Miles Davis, really because of his heroin use, along with Philly Joe Jones. But he'd actually got clean. He'd kicked heroin by this time. And by around this time, he'd actually started playing with Thelonious Monk. I think really this is some of his strongest playing on record around this period. And it was only a couple of weeks before he actually recorded Blue Train.
Yeah, I mean, his playing is very strong. It feels assured again, doesn't it? And I think there were a lot of musicians, obviously, who had dealings with heroin at this time. Some of them managed to kick it, like John Coltrane. I don't think he ever relapsed.
No,
he?
Not as far as I know.
He was almost sort of religious about it in trying to help other people not get into it. But then there were the others who it compromised their life quite a lot, obviously Sonny Clarke being one of them. I mean, it's noticeable, isn't it, that the Speak Low is almost a familiar arrangement at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost become kind of iconic, I think, in as much as it's very often people play this arrangement without even realising where it comes from. It's just become almost part of the vocabulary, hasn't it, really?
And that comes off the back of a really quite blistering With a Song in My Heart, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I think Sonny's, again, we hear him in very good comping form. And I think everyone in the band really plays well on that opening track. Great solos from Donald Byrd, again, sounds very assured. And Curtis Fuller was a good friend of Sonny Clark. They really liked each other. I think they were about the same age, and I think they had quite a lot of the same sort of feelings about how they wanted to approach music, and they were both very serious about music. And I think he's one of those very solid players, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, he sounds great on this album. And I'd also just like to mention just something I noticed, Sonny's Crib. It's a B-flat blues, and Coltrane's solo on that, I almost feel like it's almost like a bit of a warm-up for Blue Train in a way. You can really hear him kind of rehearsing a lot of the vocabulary that he brings to Blue Train. And in fact, the composition is not dissimilar from Blue Train.
Well, again, really. I mean, it's what you mentioned about Sonny's writing in general. It's a blues, but it's an AABA form with a bridge.
Yes, it has a bridge,
The bridge is quite interesting because it's sort of a rising thing to B-flat, isn't it, a few times, and then a 2-5-1 to get us back to B-flat in a more emphatic way to finish the final blues sequence.
Yeah.
And I think those sorts of forms, it gives the improviser something to think about beyond running out their blues licks, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And also, I think Sonny's tunes really do, you know, if we take the Dexter Gordon axiom that we need to be thinking about what we're doing in terms of knowing a tune, I think his tunes do frame very nicely the soloing for people. It sets up a mood very well, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, creates a mood and a good sort of frame, doesn't it, for the improvisations, really?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, every album has to have a ballad on it. So Come Rain or Come Shine is the ballad on this album. I guess it's not particularly notable for anything but being a nice ballad, really. But the tune we're going to focus on is News for Lulu. Now, many people might think that Lulu was some woman in his life, which we might mention. But Lulu was, in fact, his dog that he'd left back on the West Coast. And we have, again, we have his use of a Latin swing sort of combination, don't we?
Almost slightly reminiscent of Night in Tunisia, the bass kind of figure in the intro.
Yes, it's a lovely little... And it's in unison with the bass, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is really good. A really good effect. And I think, you know, we have to nod to Horace Silver and the sort of tendency to, and Bud Powell, of course, to have the tendency to have these sort of different feels and different bits of tunes that make into a composition more than, as you've said before, just purely blasting through another version of a rhythm changes. He punctuates the tune with his own sort of little figures that are obviously rehearsed figures, then they happen again and again. And then the bridge, that goes into swing, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it's another sort of Latin swing structure, isn't it?
Although, nearly all the time, I'm trying to think of a situation where it doesn't happen, but nearly all of his tunes that do this, they blow in swing, don't they?
Yeah, they tend to just go into swing for the blowing, yeah.
And another feature of this that we have noted in previous things with Sonny Clark, perhaps his arrangements of standards, endings particularly, he does like to go around these cycles. And this is a very good example at the end.
Yeah, it's a very common, it's almost becomes a feature of his style, really. He does it so often, this kind of particular ending. And we did talk briefly about, you know, whether there was an influence on Bill Evans, because Bill Evans also really used to like these cycle of fifths endings, whether there was some sort of cross influence.
I mean, the interesting thing for me with Sonny Clark's use of cycles is it tends to be a reharmonization of a single line or a single note, doesn't it, more than with Bill Evans he goes off on a little almost cadenza.
Yes, that's true.
In Sonny Clark's writing, it's the same figure being repeated, but over different chords as they move away from where we started. And he does seem to like these minor-major sort of sounds, which this tune ends on an F minor major 7 type sound. Well, we've talked about this particular album. It was a bit more assured, would you say, than it brings him into slightly more focus?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I mean, right from the first album, you know, there's a real sense of identity I feel, you know, he's progressing all the while, isn't he, as a writer and as a player, you know, you can hear that.
And, you know, October 57, it's still quite new. He's still quite recently arrived in New York. But he is meeting new players, and he's meeting new players with perhaps slightly different harmonic ideas to what he was appreciating on the West Coast. So we're going to move on to his next album, which is universally agreed to be his hit album, really.
So in early 1958, in January of that year, Sonny Clark went back into the Blue Note Studios to record what most people agree is his best album, called Strutting, and that was with Jackie McLean on alto saxophone, Art Farmer, again, who he'd worked with previously on Dial S for Sonny, Paul Chambers and Philly Joe Jones. It might be worth mentioning that it was quite a young band. I mean, the oldest in that band was Philly Joe Jones at 34. Jackie McLean, Sonny Clark were both 27. Art Farmer was 30, and Paul Chambers was a very young 23 when they recorded this. And so, again, it was a mixture of originals and standards. Cool Strutting and Blue Minor were the two Sonny Clark originals. And then they recorded Sipping at Bells, which was a Miles Davis tune originally recorded by Charlie Parker, and Deep Night, which was a standard that Sonny Clark first heard Bud Powell play. And that was the original album. And then there were two tracks which were actually only released on a reissue, which were Royal Flush and Lover.
Yes, I mean, it's an interesting album in general for lots of reasons. I mean, the fact that I think particularly a reissue sold more copies than Blue Train in Japan, and really the Japanese absolutely fell in love with Sonny Clark. There's an interesting idea that the Japanese sort of interest in, I suppose, a samurai tradition of sort of brutal yet beautiful combined in the same, the warrior poet, you know, sort of these paradoxes within people's sort of idea of what a great Japanese concept of art is. And perhaps Sonny Clark comes up with that. He plays a lot of minor tunes, but in some ways he always keeps it bouncy, doesn't he?
Yes, that's true, yeah.
So we'll talk about Cool Strutting in a bit in more detail. So we look at the other original that he wrote on that album, which on the original album came on side one, both of them together, and that was a tune called Blue Minor. It's another one of these minor tunes, AABA, and it's quite reminiscent of Sonny's mood, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that original. It's a sort of AABA form, again, mixing swing with Latin. So the solos are swung, but then there's a kind of Latin B section. And I mean, it's a really solid tune. And again, great comping by Sonny Clark on this tune. In fact, on this whole album, maybe we'll talk a bit more about that later. But I'm just always impressed by the quality of his comping on this album.
Well, there are a lot of people. I had a long conversation with the British drummer Matt Fishwick, who actually did live in New York for a bit as well, and played over there, about drummers and Sonny Clark, particularly on the Blue Note albums. And he thinks that everyone agrees that Philly Joe is pretty much the best fit for Sonny Clark, and talked about their quaver feel being quite similar. and locking in together. But also, Sonny Clark mentions in the liner notes, doesn't he, that he really likes Philly Joe's drumming and has some specific things to say about them.
Yeah, I mean, they're very good liner notes for this album, actually, and there's quite a lot of... I think it's probably taken from an interview with Sonny Clark, because there's a lot of direct quotes from Sonny Clark. So about Philly Joe Jones, he says, very few drummers really listen like Philly Joe Jones. He gets involved in the group effort, and he winds up inspiring you by the different little things he does, besides keeping time. Joe really makes it happen. So, you know, he's obviously... He likes the way that Philly Joe Jones, as well as obviously swinging and keeping time, he's constantly listening to what's happening, and he's kind of interacting with the other musicians. And that's obviously what Sonny Clark likes. And you can really hear that again in the comping. They set up these little rhythmic figures, and Philly Joe Jones will sort of pick up on something that Clark does. And it's a brilliant kind of ongoing dialogue between the drums and the piano on this album.
Yeah, I mean, I think you notice it in the tune as well, that Philly Joe is actually bothering to, rather than playing through, which we found in the Buddy DeFranco period, the bass player and the drummer were presumably asked to play four in a bar straight through, keep it simple, drive it along. Whereas here, the drummer is in sort of enjoying the accents that the band are playing.
Mm. Yeah, he always plays the form, doesn't he, Philly Joe Jones? He's always very aware of the form, and he never just plays through. He's always really aware of what's happening in the arrangement, you know.
And of course, Paul Chambers and Philly Joe are well known as being part of, almost a Sly and Robbie type combination, aren't they? For obviously prior to. But I noticed that in Sonny's solos on this album, there's a bit more of a Wynton Kelly sort of feel to his playing, and I wonder if that has some influence coming from the drums and bass. But also he uses octaves more in his right hand in the soloing, and there's a little lick that he uses, which I've sort of described as his sax lick, because you hear it quite often played by sax players, but it's that sort of sort of joining notes up with very fast little run in between. And that seems to come up a lot in Blue Minor. But the tune that we really need to focus on, of course, is Cool Struttin', and that's an F blues, but it's got some interesting sort of little bits in the actual tune itself, which are different in terms of the turnaround and things. So instead of just having a standard turnaround at the end of getting us back to the top, he goes B flat minor, E flat 7, A flat minor, D flat 7, G minor, C7.
Yeah, one of these cyclic sort of progressions that he liked.
Which happens just the first time, and then the second time and going into the solos, that never occurs again until the tune. And Sonny gets the first solo, which is interesting. First tune on the album, first solo, really, in a way, saying, this is my thing, you know, this is my album. And it's a really strong solo, I think. He's sort of half quotes half a pound of tuppenny rice in there, and there's a quote from a spiritual, and he also uses more and more in this period. He starts using these thirds in his soloing, which is quite interesting. Octaves and thirds seem to start turning up. The one thing I also noticed in his comping, he's in blues now. He's tending to use the tritone in the left hand rather than the shell voicing. So rather than having in this key an F at the bottom and an E flat in the thumb, he's got the E flat and the A natural of the tritone of each chord, and then moving that. I mean, he's still using the sort of held, more held, but he is starting to punctuate a bit more with the left hand.
Mm. I mean, again, I sort of keep going on about this, but his comping behind Art Farmer solo it's a masterclass of piano comping. And if I have to teach a student how to comp, you know, behind a soloist, then I tend to point them to that, because it's amazing. And the way that the two are listening to each other, and Art Farmer picks up on a sort of a voicing that Sonny Clark plays. Sonny Clark sort of, he's constantly changing, shifting. He's playing triplets. He's sort of nudging Philly Joe Jones. It's just it's so it's incredible to listen to. I love listening to him playing behind, behind the soloists on that track.
Yeah, I mean, he at one point he also goes into a sort of blues figuration, sort of ba-da-dun-da-dun, doesn't
yeah,
he, as
yeah,
well?
Just a repeating riff, which he plays behind the soloist, which is nice.
So almost thinking like a big band.
Yeah, yeah, like a riff, exactly. Yeah, riffing.
I mean, the overall album obviously becomes his calling card, and that cover is a particularly striking one. It's one that's been, it's often referred to. And it's believed that the legs on the front of the cover are, in fact, Alfred Lyon's wife, shot by Francis Wolfe.
Yeah, allegedly. We should
allegedly,
say.
Yeah. And there's also this, in the liner notes, a sort of cryptic message saying that it was dedicated to his wife. Now, Sonny Clark's wife is a mysterious figure, if she indeed existed. But you did find something in Jet magazine, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I sort of did a bit of trawling through the internet. And the only real mention I could find was in Jet magazine, which was a magazine for Afro-Americans, which I think started in the 50s, if I'm right.
I mean, there had been newspapers which focused on Black American, like the New Amsterdam, the Harlem Press. And there was a guy called Dan Burley who was a very... the Harlem Renaissance that had happened, and he was a poet, a pianist, a lyricist. He was a really big man, and in terms of, he wrote a sports column as well. And it's interesting how Jet is sort of the first glossy fashion, almost like Time or Life magazine, for the Black community,
but also
and it was very successful.
But also, you know, had a kind of political. It was quite political as well, wasn't it? And talked a lot about civil rights, and you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these publications were left alone. They weren't considered, much like the records of the 1940s, which they used to describe as race records. They were left alone to do their thing, and the record companies made the records, put them out. They sold. They made some more records. They put them out. They didn't really think of it as mainstream culture. And I think it was the same for the press, really. So whereas in a glossy magazine here now, you would be very, it's all puff pieces. You wouldn't be likely to find so much hard-hitting political journalism. I think that Jet and Ebony that followed, they did have a lot to do with the civil rights movement.
Yeah. Anyway, we're talking about this because there was a reference in one of these magazines to Sonny Clark introducing his wife to his friends, and she was a model called Delphine Moore. I think he, according to this, he married her when he was working with Buddy DeFranco. But other than that, I could find no other reference to her whatsoever, really. So, as you say, she's a bit of a mysterious figure.
There's some sort of mention at the very end of his life there was a benefit concert given by people like Bill Evans and to raise money for his wife and children.
Yeah, I think that was organised by the Baroness Panonica. She organised it. But yes, there was mention. He did leave, I think, a wife and children. Whether that was the same wife or different, we don't really know. Anyway, yeah.
A difficult little thing to work out. Well, I think that concludes our analysis of Cool Strutting, and we'll move on to My Conception. The next album that Sonny was in the studio for was released as My Conception. It was recorded in March 1959, on the 29th of March, in between the two sessions which comprised the Kind of Blue recordings. The band featured Donald Byrd on trumpet, return of Hank Mobley on tenor, Paul Chambers on bass, and Art Blakey on drums. And we're not going to talk in much detail about the tunes on this album. They're all original tunes, but actually they were recorded again in 1960 on the Time label as trio tunes, so we can deal with them in more detail next episode, where we'll be looking at Sonny Clark as a trio leader and also a bit more about his style as an improviser and tune writer. So just to give you an idea, the tunes that were released on the first vinyl edition were Junker, Blues Blues, Minor Meeting, Royal Flush, Some Clark Bars, and My Conception. Junker is similar to Sonny's Mood structurally. It's a 32-bar song form. And the one thing I noticed was at the end of Sonny's solo, he does something which is turning up more and more, which is he's signing off with a difference. He's using two chords that are adjacent. So he'll play G-flat to F, G-flat to F, G-flat to F, G-flat to F in quick succession, which gives a little sort of tension and release in microcosm. And then we go on to Blues Blues, which is a Art Blakey shuffle vibe. You know, he was very famous for that. Hank Mobley's in strong voice. Donald Byrd plays really well. The whole band sounds incredibly positive. And in fact, this album is a mystery to me why it didn't come out, because in some respects, it's one of Sonny Clark's best.
Mm.
He does a brilliant solo on that blues, and he signs off in a slightly new way. We spoke before about how he played with signing off with a sort of much more bluesy end, particularly on standards where he didn't use blues much at all until the very last phrase. But now he seems to be signing off a bit more with sort of two-hand or block chords to signal this is the end of my solo. Then we have Minor Meeting, and this is an interesting one, isn't it, Nick? Because we've got two versions of Minor Meeting.
Yeah, so there was the... Well, he recorded it for the version that was released on vinyl, but then he also recorded it. He's recorded it a couple more times. In fact, he recorded it the first time was on the West Coast, wasn't it? Is that correct?
Yeah, he recorded it on an album called Tenor Man, which was a Lawrence Murrible album featuring tenor player called James Clay. And that version is in C minor, and that's the same as the version with Cliff Jordan and Kenny Burrell, which is the other quintet, as it were, which we're going to talk about in a bit. But the one that was released first of all is in fact in G minor.
Yeah, and it is quite interesting to compare. And he also records it. With a trio, doesn't he? There's a trio version of it as well. So it's kind of interesting to compare. And he really changes it quite a lot. I mean, if you compare, for example, the trio version with the version on My Conception, it's very different. I mean, even the changes are slightly different, not hugely, but slightly different. And he's obviously reimagining it for the larger ensemble, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a tune we should look at in much more detail when we look at the trio, because we can refer back. There's a rhythm changes on there. There's Royal Flush, which we've already mentioned, because it didn't make it onto his last album, and he records it for this album, which is an interesting thing as well. And then there's a tune called Some Clark Bars, which is another rhythm changes, but you wouldn't necessarily know it from the head. He has a sort of slash chord rhythmic backing thing going on, which is a little dissonant. The album's title track, My Conception, which is a lovely ballad, and it has some similarities, as people have pointed out before, with Waltz for Debbie. And you've got some thoughts on that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of discussion about whether there was some kind of inspiration from Waltz for Debbie. I mean, Waltz for Debbie was almost certainly written first. I looked in Bill Evans's biography, and it seems as if that tune was written around about 1954, although he didn't record it until 1956 on New Jazz Conceptions, which was his first trio album. And so some people have kind of conjectured whether Sonny Clark was influenced by that tune. I mean, there are superficial similarities between the two, and it is also known, as we've mentioned, that the two were friends. You know, they were friends, and Bill Evans always cited Sonny Clark as an influence on his own style, you know, and had a lot of respect for him. But I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, Simon. I mean, I think it's a little bit tenuous. I mean, it's a very common chord progression. You know, it's a 1-6-2-5 chord progression. He's got these kind of descending fifths in the melody, and I think it's quite a superficial likeness. I don't know what you feel about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there were flavors around, weren't there, at the time, of tunes which some people heard people play things. They wrote tunes similar to things they heard other people play, but in their own way, I think it's probably no further than that. I mean, to me, the most interesting thing about it is the tune writing, that drop of a fifth that you've talked about, and that goes all the way through the tune, including the bridge. And I suppose also the fact that it's a good example of his ballad playing, which we can deal with, obviously, in the final episode, which we're going to look at his playing as a ballad pianist. And we can look at My Conception also in a bit more detail, tune-wise, on the trio album. So I think that wraps it up for this album.
On November the 13th, 1961, Sonny Clark went to the new Van Gelder studio in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, to record what would be his last album as leader for Blue Note, which was called Leaping and Loping. The personnel for this album was completely new in terms of his recordings for Blue Note. He hadn't recorded with any of these musicians before. So there was Tommy Turrentine on trumpet, brother of Stanley Turrentine, the saxophonist. Charlie Rouse on tenor sax, who was probably best known for being a long-standing member of Thelonious Monk's quartet. And then Butch Warren and Billy Higgins. Butch Warren on bass, Billy Higgins on drums. The same rhythm section, actually, who recorded the two Dexter Gordon albums, Go and A Swinging Affair, a bit later. And he met these musicians. He'd been playing, apparently, in some East Village clubs. And there was a particular coffee house called The White Whale. And it seems that he met a lot of these musicians there, Tommy Turrentine, Billy Higgins, and liked their playing. And that's kind of how he got to work with them, really. The album as released, the vinyl release, had Something Special, which was a Clark original, Deep in a Dream, which was a Van Heusen, Jimmy Van Heusen tune, which Clark had actually recorded before, Melody for Sea, another Clark original, Eric Walks, which was an original by Butch Warren, the bass player, and Voodoo, which we're going to talk a bit more about later, which was another Clark original. Because in those days, they could only really record, they could only really release rather 40 minutes of music. Very often tunes sort of got left off. They had to make a choice between tunes. So there was another tune called Zelmar's Delight, which they originally recorded, but was only released later on the reissue. And there was also an alternate take of Melody for Sea, a long take, which again was which was put onto the reissue but wasn't released on the original vinyl.
Yes, although you did leave off Midnight Mambo, which was a Tommy Turrentine.
Oh yeah, sorry, tune, yes,
which
yes,
managed to get onto yes. onto the vinyl release.
Yes, they managed to squeeze that one. Squeeze that one.
I mean, it's interesting because I think that is undoubtedly the reason why there isn't Zelmar's Delight on there. It's a great tune. It probably wasn't played as well. The head wasn't played quite as well as everything else. So that might have been a thing that made a decision. But Melody for all of these tunes are is sort of 7 minutes long. The only ones that come anywhere shorter are Eric Walks, which is about 5.5 minutes, which is the same length as Zelmar's Delight. So they had to choose between those two, I guess, for the original release. And in terms of technology, by this point, Rudy Van Gelder had solidified his technique, and that was to have the trumpet on the left, I think, and the saxophone on the right. So you could pan hard left, hard right, or B in the middle. He then worked out that it was best to have the bass in the middle, because when you have bass on one side, it can cause difficulties with the cutting of the record. Remembering that Rudy Van Gelder had his own lathe and mastered the whole thing himself. So he had come up with this technique where he could make a stereo and a mono recording with the same tape without having to have two different tapes running. And the sax and the drums were on the right-hand side, and the piano as well, and the bass was in the middle. And that's really true for so many of these choices that they had to make. Just like originally the 3-minute pop song probably comes from the fact that that's about as much as you could squeeze onto a 78 record. Mm-hmm. And it just became a kind of a standard.
Mm.
Oh, another thing that I find quite interesting about this is the album's called Leapin' and Lopin', with the use of apostrophes. And there isn't a tune called that. So it's almost a description of the concept of the album, as opposed to the actual, you know, just saying, well, that we'll call it Voodoo, or we'll call it Melody for Sea, or whatever. I thought that was quite an interesting change, and it gives us an idea of how the album has its variety, because some of the tunes are quite sort of quick and leaping, and some of them are loping, quite slow, and particularly Voodoo, it's got a very almost film noir sort of bass line, hasn't it?
Yes.
And it it really does sort of lope along. And then you get Midnight Mambo, which is quite brisk, and things like that.
Mm.
So let's quickly go through the tunes that we're not going to talk about in detail. Something Special. It's another one of Sonny Clark's blues, but not a blues.
Mm.
So it is a blues when they blow on it. But there's that really, for me, the most significant interesting point in the composition is that it goes into a sort of, I suppose it's crotchet triplets. So it almost goes into 6-4. But in the space of a 4-4 bar, in the tag, and they do that.
Yeah.
The coda is the same thing, but even, as it were, even more so.
Yeah.
So it just stays in that sort of triple time. So it's really the drums that are doing it, and the melody sort of picks up on that. But it's quite interesting, and no one ever blows in 6; it's always in 4.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's a really nice mature solo from Sonny Clark on this tune as well. He's getting rid of his quotes. It's more straight down the line, although he does sort of hint at an English country garden at one point.
Yeah, but I think there's the theme from Carmen crops up as well, doesn't it? I just made a note.
Yeah, so, I mean, almost. It's that thing where his quotes are becoming suggestions rather than direct, I suppose. And I find it, I mean, that da 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 do do do, that quote comes up a lot on minor tunes, doesn't it?
It's a favorite,
in many people's soloing. Deep in a Dream is a tune which you've talked about a bit.
I mean, he previously recorded it, didn't he, with on a Hank Moby album, and here he does it as a quartet with Ike Quebec. Ike Quebec is a tenor player who we've talked about a bit before, because he was, I mean, you brought my attention to this, Simon. I didn't really know this, but he did actually sort of work for Blue Note, didn't he, as an A&R?
Yeah,
he was sort of finding talent, really, I guess.
Yeah, he was an A&R man, really, for them. And, of course, his heyday arguably is the 1940s, not so much later on.
Yeah, he was older, wasn't he? He was a generation older.
Yeah, he was sort of a generation older. And I find it really interesting the way that Sonny Clark reacts to him as a soloist on this one track. You know, and I don't, this is complete conjecture, but I do wonder if it was, we'd like to do Deep in a Dream, and Charlie Rouse said, oh, that's not one I know. And Ike Quebec could have just said, oh, well, I know that one, I'll play that.
Could
one
well then. Be, yeah. No, absolutely.
He might just been in the recording studio in his role as A&R man. But particularly on the bridge, Sonny plays these much more Teddy Wilson-like runs or Art Tatum-like runs.
Yeah, you can hear him sort of adapting his style, can't you, to that slightly older way of playing. You know, it's interesting.
And also a slightly older tune. It was written probably in the 20s, was it? I can't remember exactly.
I'm not sure. Yeah, it's quite an old tune, yeah.
But it's one of the things I've learnt over time is when I think of a tune as being, oh, yeah, that's from the 50s, it's nearly always not.
Yeah.
It's nearly always from 1920-something.
Yeah.
And then the next tune, at least in the order they recorded them the order they came out on the original album, Melody for Sea. I'm assuming the sea is Charlie Rouse, but maybe not. But it's interesting to me because it's sort of quasi-modal. That's not someone who rings a bell. I mean, modal jazz being quite the thing, that a la mode.
Yeah.
It's not modal, but it's in two major keys. So it's that thing where the bridge is the same but up a fourth.
Yeah, it's just sort of transposed, isn't it? Transposed up, you know.
And it's got that moving up and down of chords.
Yeah.
A bit like sort of Milestones or something like that. So it maybe is a nod to that sort of style. And one of the other things I noticed about it, I don't know if you have any further observations, but in his comping behind Tommy Turrentine, he sort of does these almost Hammond organ-like falls, you know, sort of bow.
Yeah, bow. Yes. Yeah.
Or, you know, perhaps big band trumpet section.
Yeah, sort of glissando sort of.
Yeah, downward things, which is very Jimmy Smith.
And he doesn't really do that. I haven't really heard him do that before, really. It's an interesting effect that he kind of just seems to do on that tune, you know.
Yeah, and only for that solo. And that one time. But the other thing I wonder is that there's a sort of syncopated stab type backing for the bass solo, and Butch Warren is soloing, and Billy Higgins plays in sync with Sonny Clark. Now, whether that was an on the session listening type thing, or whether they'd pre-arranged it.
Yeah, I mean, I've made a note. Clark plays arranged hits, so I kind of assume they were sort of arranged. But like you say, maybe they just had put them together, you know, on the spot, and it's hard to know exactly how they did that, really.
Yeah, I mean, I in my mind it was a question because it doesn't quite happen the first time, and then Billy Higgins seems to pick up on it. But we're talking about the possibility that he forgot and then remembered or reacted very quickly. So Eric Walks is a tune by Butch Warren, and he didn't play for Blue Note for very long. He had quite a difficult life, actually. He had spent some time in prison. But it is a really interesting tune, this one. There's that tag that happens in between solos for the horns that's sort of like a bit like Sure Enough, isn't it?
Mm.
And it's got quite an interesting sequence that never really settles. It doesn't seem to have a clear beginning and an end, sequence.
No.
So you end up wondering, your ear is searching for the top of the chorus a bit, because there's lots of similarities but also differences all the time. But I think Sonny seems the most comfortable with those slightly tricky changes, if you like.
Yeah, he's very good. He always flows, and even those tricky cyclical sort of progressions which trip some pianists up, you know. You hear even some renowned pianists from this time, you know, when they encounter these, but he always sort of seems to sail over them, you know. He doesn't have any problem with these progressions, really.
Well, before we go into a bit of detail on Voodoo, we should mention Midnight Mambo, and that's a tune by the trumpeter Tommy Turrentine, as you said, the older brother of Stanley Turrentine, the sax player. And again, it's a Latin head, and this album seems to have these slightly off melodies, doesn't it? They're not quite in the chord. Some of the notes are, so there's a chord being played, and some of the notes are outside of the chord.
Yeah.
One of the things I would say about Sonny Clark's playing in general is he isn't an outside player. He does stick with the chords that he's playing in a tune. He's not one of those people who side slips much or takes things away and brings them back. And so these extra notes that are coming in are quite interesting to me. There's a sort of an altered scale sound going on in that melody. And it reminds me, it kind of foreshadows Sonny's really nice solo on Soy Khalifa for me. It's got a sort of fixed, almost Montuno-like, more correctly, two Montunos, because there's sort of an A and a B section. Yeah, I just thought he really, really nailed it. And then we get a really nice Latin sort of solo from Billy Higgins before you come in.
Mm.
And the other notable thing about that tune, and we're going to talk about it in Voodoo, is that these are the only two times I think I've encountered a fade-out on any Sonny Clark records.
Mm.
And this was becoming much more popular with people like Herbie Hancock and his tunes. They, you know, have this sort of, we leave the band continuing to groove over the melody or the tag or whatever it is that they're playing. So we should talk about Voodoo. Mm. Do you have any opening thoughts on that?
Well, it's a very interesting tune. It's really unlike any of his other compositions in a way. It really kind of stands out. So it's in D minor, and as you said, it's got this kind of sort of medium swing, this kind of descending bass line. And then the A section has this kind of repeated phrase. And the interesting thing is it keeps emphasizing this E flat. Now the tune is in D minor. So E flat is a very dissonant note against the D minor. Although the chords are changing, it's still kind of the prevailing tonality is D minor. So you've got this kind of dissonant E flat. And I suppose the obvious comparison is with Thelonious Monk. I mean, it kind of strikes me. I mean, he does mention, I think in one of the liner notes actually, he does kind of say how much he likes Monk and his compositions and actually also his piano playing, which is interesting. So I think that's a fairly obvious, an obvious connection. And also some Monk tunes like Friday the 13th just have this kind of repetitive, almost, insistent phrase which just keeps repeating, and it kind of reminds me of that sort of
definitely
effect, really.
I mean, I've written down here exactly that word: insistent, slightly menacing, and mesmerizing melody.
Sort of, menacing is a good way of describing it, I think.
I wonder whether that's partly, you know, mood painting, voodoo, sort of almost the chanting of voodoo, kind of incantation. Might have something to do with that. If I have a problem with this tune, it's that when you get into the blowing, so the bridge again is that very different feel to the main tune, and it's a repeated single note, which we find a lot in Sonny Clark's tunes.
Yeah,
and he does change the chords, but it's going sort of D minor to C, B flat back to C. And I find that in the blowing, that difference is not that noticeable. It's the key center being still D minor, really. And I find it a little bit, you know, lacking in contrast, I suppose, when they're blowing. Having said that, I still think it's one of his best tunes because of the sort of the direction it's showing he may have gone in if he hadn't died.
Yeah, and the bridge also, it sort of uses this device that you've talked about where he's got this repeated note, but the harmony's changing under the note, isn't it? So it creates this kind of shifting sort of tonality, but with this, just again, it's this kind of insistent, repeated note. So it's a really interesting tune, I think.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we the pressure of time has got to us, and we need to wrap up, unfortunately. But we'd like to thank our listeners for listening. We've actually, during the recording of this podcast, we've passed our 200th download, which is very exciting for us. Our main aim of doing this is to obviously spread the word about perhaps an underrated pianist, someone who's a bit under the radar. And we will be producing material such as lead sheets and solo transcriptions, which will go into the ebook that we will publish eventually. And I think you were going to mention a nice comment you had from one of your workshop students.
I got a nice message just sort of saying, I have to paraphrase it, I don't actually have the quote, but he sort of said that it really made him sort of re-listen to his old kind of recordings again, and you know, the fact that he'd sort of heard Sonny Clark without really realizing that he was listening to Sonny Clark, which is kind of interesting. And which again, as you said, Simon, is kind of the reason for this is to hopefully just shine a bit of a spotlight on him as a player in his own right, and not merely a kind of an accompanist, you know.
Well, thanks for listening. And that brings to the end episode 3 of 251. So from me, Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And from me, Nick Tomlin, goodbye.